Welcome to the next installment of the Science Progress interview series. Today we're talking with Dr. Saad Omer, the Associate Director of the Institute for Vaccine Safety at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We've gotten in touch with Dr. Omer to learn more about vaccine safety and policy. What we want to talk to Dr. Omer today about is some of the recent news coverage of vaccine safety, and in particular some connections that people have been making between vaccine safety and autism. And a lot of recent media coverage has actually focused on the March ruling from the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program to Terry and John Pulling, who claimed that a vaccine contributed to their daughter Hannah's development of autism. Now, in New York Times editorial, Paul Offit of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia actually laments the fact that the program abandoned a previous standard for a preponderance of evidence for determining the link between vaccines and injuries, and instead ruled that their claim was made on standards of biological plausibility. Now, my question is there a problem with the way that the vaccine injury compensation program ruled on this, and what does it say about the way we're approaching vaccines in general?
So let me start with the case, since you brought it up. Just to briefly describe the case for those who are not familiar with it, it was a case of a 19-month-old girl who received several vaccines together after a delay due to recurrent bouts of otitis media or ear infection. And so those vaccines were administered together and developed some symptoms after that. And at, I think, 23-month assessment, she was assessed and was diagnosed with having mild symptoms of autism spectrum disorder, and during her evaluation, she was diagnosed with a mitochondrial disorder. Mm-hmm. So there was apparently a claim was filed for the federal court, and the government settled, basically awarding them compensation for that, and that's what the case is. And so to put things in perspective for that case, and in terms of people drawing conclusions from it, I would caution that this is just a case, and the question I often ask, even within the scientific community, is where are the controls? Because when we assess scientific evidence, we need to keep in mind that we need to compare an association of an event with an outcome in both cases and controls. And we haven't had that kind of evaluation yet. And I can go into specific examples of what problems one can have. However, this is a biologically plausible hypothesis. And what does that mean? That means that we can explore, should explore, this kind of hypothesis under a counterfactual model, but should not draw a conclusion from it at this point. And just to clarify, while we are at this topic, even if this link is established, and what it says is that mitochondrial disorder, which is a kind of disorder in the cell's energy mechanism, is proven to be exacerbated by vaccine and result in autism spectrum disorders, metabolic disorder is very rare, and it would explain a very small proportion of autism diseases. So just to put that in perspective, now the second part of your question, whether the change in standard that the vaccine court that resulted in awarding of these compensation, first of all, it wasn't the injury compensation program that changed it. It was the interpretation of a couple of decisions, circuit court decisions, and these higher court decisions were as a result of some cases from the compensation program were appealed, and there were a couple of decisions, and the special masters of the compensation program, not the HHS, interpret as having said that the evidence should be evaluated on a standard of biologically plausible. I think that's dangerous, because I can sit here and come up with 20, 30 different hypotheses which would be biologically plausible on several biological models. We're not talking about probable, we're talking about plausible. And even with probable models, we know how human body is complex, is very complex. And if you test 20 different biological hypotheses, a great proportion, I would hazard to say that a majority of them don't pan out in humans. So I think it's not a very robust standard to go by, because what we are saying is that we would have a judgments on these cases based on something that could happen, not something that does happen.
Backing up just a little bit more to talk more generally about vaccine safety, the government has programs that do vaccine surveillance and maintain safety. Could you talk a little bit about what those programs are and how effective they are?
Briefly, so one major program is the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, which is jointly managed by the CDC and the FDA, in which reports of events that seem to be associated with vaccines, adverse events, are reported into that system. It's a good system for generating signals, but it has its limitations. But the major limitation is we don't have a denominator, a good denominator to calculate a rate. So we cannot assume that all the doses that went into the market were administered, so we don't know the rates. But another interesting problem that has come up is that due to the fact that in the U.S. adverse event reporting system, anyone can basically report a case into a system. And there was a recent analysis that was published in Pediatrics that showed most of the rise in reports of autism-related symptoms associated with vaccines has been due to increased reporting of litigation-associated cases. So we have that kind of a problem with VAERS, but it still has a lot of utility in terms of generating signals. For example, it generated a signal for the old rotavirus vaccine. Then the CDC has the Vaccine Safety Data Link, which is a combination. So what they have is they have put together a system by linking databases from several large HMOs, and it covers approximately 2% of the U.S. population, 0 to 6 years. And they sometimes, since fortunately vaccine events are rare, you need large databases to get enough numbers and do robust scientific studies. So that's a good system. Then there's Clinical Immunization Safety Assessment Network, which is a network of a few centers of excellence, mostly academic centers, coordinated by the CDC to assess vaccine safety in a clinical setting. So this is basically what the vaccine safety system is in the U.S. However, I must say, I think vaccine safety needs a lot more resources than it is provided, because these studies, fortunately, as I said, vaccine events are rare, and so you need large numbers to study these phenomena, and the resources that are available are very low.
Because some of what has generated mainstream coverage recently has to do with very personal decisions, and like you were saying, parents are reporting events in connection with increased coverage of the litigation. These are very personal choices that parents are making about whether or not to exempt their children from getting vaccinations. What do you say to parents who might be thinking about exempting their children from getting vaccines because of what they might have heard about these possible links to autism?
So as I said, there have been several studies, both in the U.S., and outside in Denmark and other parts of Europe, that have looked at the issue of vaccines and autism, and we haven't found any credible signal, any credible association between vaccines, either thimerosal, which is a mercury preservative that was of concern a few years ago, and MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, and autism. So there have been several studies, and our website, vaccinesafety.edu, discusses some of these issues, and so people can go and look it up, specific evidence related to that. On the other hand, we know that there is a risk of, even an individual-level risk, of acquiring vaccine-preventable diseases in the United States if your child is not vaccinated. For example, in a study, in a national level study, it was found that kids who were exempt from vaccination requirements had 33 times, it's not percent, it's times, higher risk of acquiring measles with those who are vaccinated, who do not seek exemptions, and 6 times higher risk of acquiring pertussis in Colorado. The pertussis study was in Colorado than those that are vaccinated. So there are real risks involved in terms of acquiring vaccine-preventable diseases. One last point in this regard. We do know that congenital rubella syndrome is associated, and there are some studies that's showing an association between that and autism-like symptoms. And so we know that part of that syndrome is explained by a congenital rubella syndrome, which used to occur when the population level immunity in the U.S. was relatively low. So actually, MMR vaccine or measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine prevents against a cause or something that is associated with autism. So in terms of, if you are thinking even specifically in terms of autism, one should consider that we are talking about something that prevents autism. Basically, it's congenital rubella syndrome is when mothers get rubella in pregnancies, their children develop certain abnormalities.
So in your experience, where does this misinformation about the risks of vaccination come from? Is it usually generated through parents talking to parents? Is it media? Is it doctors talking to parents?
It's several sources, and we found that in our studies of looking at parents of exempt children, children who are exempt from vaccination requirement compared to those vaccinated, there was an association with types of provider, trust in government, trust in providers, the sources of information. You know, people tended to get the information from some of the advocacy sites, tended to vaccinate, you know, tended to seek exemptions at a higher rate, etc. So yeah, so there are several sources of that, and there are some very passionate people who very passionately feel that there is an association between vaccines and autism. That includes some celebrities as well. So that gets people's attention. On the other hand, I must say that most parents, even those who are concerned about vaccine safety, are coming from the right place. All of us want our children to be safe from any harm, including harms for any pharmaceutical interventions. So we shouldn't be dismissive of that, but it's our responsibility for us in the public health community to put out the right information so that people make a truly informed decision about the risk and benefit of vaccines and vaccine-preventable diseases.
One final question, just to wrap up. What do you think is sort of most important for people who are both working in the public health community, people who are policymakers who may be hearing about this issue, and for parents to take away from this whole conversation that's being had in the public sphere at the moment?
Yeah, so one thing that people should realize that we know that vaccines have some side effects, and we should acknowledge that, everyone who's involved with that. However, the risk and benefit calculus for all vaccines that are out there based on our current knowledge heavily favors not only getting your child vaccinated, but also getting them vaccinated according to the specified schedule. Because the risk of disease, I have seen a new trend where people are splitting the difference and saying, okay, I'm going to get my kid vaccinated, but I'm going to get them vaccinated late. Well, the risk of illness is not constant across childhood. And so that's why the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and the American Academy of Pediatrics come up with these recommendations to look at several factors, including the burden of disease. So it's important to not only get your child vaccinated, but also get them vaccinated per specified schedule.